Our study on the days of creation is in response to a topic that was submitted for this quarter. The importance of our topic, we looked at it in a previous study, and the prayer we just prayed with Bill, that we can live the life that God wants us to live and follow His will, can be impacted by our views of this very basic subject. So we looked at the importance, how it affects our view of the nature of man. Is he unique and made in the image of God, completely different from the animal kingdom, with moral responsibility and accountability? We looked at how it affects marriage, created by God, and the obligations that are involved, that is for two people for life. We looked at how it impacted our view of how sin entered the world and spiritual death through that sin. We looked at the fact that physical death also was the result of what these two people did, and they were shut out of the garden and had no opportunity to return to the tree of life, and therefore mortality became the last step in our earthly existence. And then the plan of redemption was introduced in chapter 3. From the seed of that woman would bruise the head of the serpent, set in place God's plan. And of course, the glory to God as seen in this instantaneous creation in 6 days through the power of His Word. And then all of that is set in contrast to the theory of evolution, where instead of God by His infinite power creating the universe, it was simply a process of natural forces over a period of millions of years. Then we looked at some evidences for the fact that the days were actual days as we speak of them, normal days, 24-hour days, solar days, whatever you want to call it. We looked at the fact that the word that is used when used with a number always indicates that kind of day. The word day can be used to refer to a period, but when it has a number in front of it, that's the way it's used. And then we looked at the fact that the phrase evening and morning completely confirms the use of day in Genesis 1. While the word day has other usages, every time, to my knowledge, that you have the phrase evening and morning together, it's always framing a normal 24-hour or solar day. We looked at that in the writings of Moses. And then we looked at the Exodus chapter 20, where the word day occurs 6 times. Right in the middle of those occurrences are the creation days. And that further defines how those creation days were viewed by Moses, who wrote Genesis, and then, of course, this letter also. And then we have the natural import of the language, let there be light. How would those people understand it? You see that also in their writings. And then we looked at the difficulties with making days ages, because you'd have thousands of years of darkness. How would the plants survive? And then also, how would the plants survive without pollination by insects? And then we saw that the account is written like a historical account. You have these superscriptions that indicate that, and that's the way it's treated throughout the Bible, and we looked quickly at a number of passages where that's the case. And so we're at this point in our study. This is where we left off. So turn to Matthew chapter 19, verse 4. Matthew chapter 19, verse 4. Here we have Jesus' testimony. Sometimes when we're trying to settle an issue, we look for authoritative testimony, authoritative witness. You can't get more authoritative than Jesus. If He is indeed the Son of God, He was there. In fact, John tells us in John 1, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him. And so Jesus was there when this happened. And now He's on the earth, and here's His statement in Matthew 19 and 4. Have you not read? The "have you not read" refers to the passages we're studying in this class, Genesis 1 and 2. Have you not read that He who created them from the beginning made them male and female? So here He says this happened not millions of years down the stream of history, but in the beginning. You'll note that He clearly indicates it was two people, a male and a female. And he says the two, verse 5, should be one flesh. He actually uses the number two in verse 5. And here he sets God's plan for marriage in place. Obviously, if the theory of evolution is true, men and women have been around, maybe in lesser form, but for hundreds of thousands of years. And so Jesus' statement loses validity, and really the question gets down to, is Jesus the Son of God or not? Does he lose his credibility by talking about a man and a woman in the beginning and God instituting this relationship between them that we know as marriage? So, at least in my thinking, these are very strong evidences of the fact that the days of creation were normal, what we would call 24-hour or solar days. We often hear a lot in our schools, in our museums, in colleges, on television about evolutionary time. One of the reasons that some have bought into what's called theistic evolution, that is the idea that I still believe in God, but God brought about what we see over millions and billions of years, is because they feel like the evidence is so strong. And one of those evidences is evolutionary time. We're told, as if it's a matter of fact, that our earth is several billion years old, that man is several million years old, and that's proven by scientific procedures. But is that true? Have people been sold a bill of goods? So let's spend just a few minutes and look at that. This would be an interesting study if you wish to do it on your own sometime. It'd be a good study to do with your children. But what we've got here is an hourglass. You're familiar with like an egg timer, but we're calling this an hourglass. And by calling it an hourglass, what we're saying is that if the top part of that glass is full of sand or whatever they put in it, it's designed so that once it starts in 1 hour, the top will be empty. It will all be in the bottom. And thus your hour is measured. So you can look at that hourglass, and if half of it's in the top and half of it's in the bottom, you say, how long has this hourglass been running? You say, well, 30 minutes. 30 minutes. If you look at it and you say, 75% of the sand's in the bottom and only 25% in the top, how long has this hourglass been running? You say, well, 45 minutes. And so that's a very simple thing that we're familiar with. And for somebody like me, it needs to be simple. When you start talking about radioactive elements and their rate of decay, I'm easily lost. And so I saw this illustration many years ago, and I found it again for this study. It's really stuck with me, and it's something that I can get a grasp on. Hopefully it'll be helpful to you as well. And so when you talk about this, there are three assumptions for this to work. The first assumption is that the rate of radioactive decay, so the sand in the top, we're going to call that some kind of radioactive elements or isotopes, and they change to another form. So you don't have to worry about all of that. We're going to deal with sand. So the rate of radioactive decay, or the sand going through the hourglass, is known and has been constant since the rock formed. And so in the case of our hourglass, if you see half in the top and half in the bottom, and you say, well, it's been going for 30 minutes, you're assuming that whole 30 minutes has been running through there at the rate you're now observing. Obviously, if for some reason 15 minutes ago the rate was different, your conclusions would be in error. So you watch it for 3 minutes, you say, oh, I see what rate it is, and I'm going to assume that's the way it's been doing for the last 30 minutes, and you reach your conclusions. This is what is done in the dating systems about radioactive elements. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. That's one of the assumptions. You can see how critical that is to the hourglass. Here's the second assumption. there has been no loss or gain of the parent or daughter isotope from the rock. Don't worry about that word isotope. It's an element, has radioactivity. Let's use our hourglass. What we're saying by comparison is that in this hourglass, you're looking at it, and you're saying, oh yeah, half of it's on the bottom. What if you didn't know it, but on the bottom of that hourglass, there was a tiny little hole. And some of that sand had been leaking out. You thought it was half. But actually, more than half is run. The others ran out. Or maybe there was some way from the top of that hourglass that somebody added some additional sand. Now all your calculations would be off. You have to assume that there has been no loss or no gain in either the top portion or the bottom portion, that is, in the radioactive isotope and what it's turning into, which is lead. And so that's what you have to assume. That's an assumption. And then the third assumption is that the amounts of the parent and daughter isotopes present when the rock formed are known. So I told you that when this timer started, there was an hour worth of sand in the top. Do you know that? You just have to trust me. Now, we're not talking about trusting somebody about an hourglass. We're talking about going back billions of years and assuming that these rocks had none of the stuff in the bottom. It was all in the top. In other words, the radioactive isotopes had not begun to decay. And now then they began to decay and get this other, turn into this other stuff that it decays into, lead. So anyway, that's three assumptions. Now you can understand that about an hourglass. That's not difficult to see that for that hourglass illustration to work. You have to make those three assumptions. Okay. Let's go back now. Let's take that first one. You're told, your children are told, that the rate of decay of these radioactive elements has been constant for millions of years. Now, on this hourglass that we illustrated, you saw that little neck. Let's suppose whoever designed that hourglass put a valve on the back of that neck. And you've been observing that hourglass for, say, 5 minutes. But let's suppose that, 20 minutes ago, right after it started, somebody got that valve on the back of it and opened it wide open. You've been watching it, but maybe the valve's been partly shut. And if they opened it wide open, what's going to happen to that sand? It's going to rush through there a lot faster. So you've got this hour's worth of sand, you think, in the top at the rate that you're watching it. But if somebody turned that timer and that sand ran through a whole lot faster, you might look at that timer and say, you know, there's only 10% of the sand in the top. 10%. And so 10% of 60 minutes, that's 6 minutes. It's been running 54 minutes. But, see, back there when it was running 5 minutes, somebody opened that valve and it ran at the rate that's a whole lot faster. It might have only been running 20 minutes because a lot of it went through when that valve was wide open. That's in the illustration with the hourglass. So the assumption that the rate that people observe now, and this does happen, and they time this, they have a way to do it, measure radioactive decay, but what they're assuming is that the rate is uniform, In other words, what you see today is a key to the past. That's what's called uniformitarianism. It's a key to evolution. And so they're assuming that what's going on today has always been that way, that there's never been a change in the rate of decay. I have here a quote that I found, and I thought it was very interesting and very perceptive. The observation upon which this rate of decay is based is maybe about 50 years old. The enlarged quote here says, we've only known about radioactive decay for about a century, and we have at most observed radioactive decay rate for 20 to 30 years on one sample of material. So based on 50 years, so let's just move it on out to 50 years. So we're observing this rate of radioactive decay for 50 years. And we're taking what we observed for 50 years and we're postulating that that's what happened for 50 million years. Whoa. We watch this little bitty speck of time and then assume it's always been that way. The figure that I have up on the slide, 0.0000001. You can see how small a percentage that is. To make it an illustration that we can maybe better get a grasp on, at least it helps me. Let's suppose we want to talk about the stock market. So how does the stock market work? So I've got some money I want to invest, so you go find a stock broker. And say, well, how does this stock market work? He says, well, here's how it works. Well, how do you know it works that way? Well, I spent 5 seconds looking at it. 5 seconds? That's all your experience? Yeah. And I can tell you what it's going to do next week and next year and next month and what it's done for the last 50 years. How much time did you spend looking at it? Watch it. 5 seconds. You want to invest your money? I don't think you do. Well, that's like trying to say with our little bitty observation, we know what's been happening for the last 50 billion years. We do not know. We do not know. Now, you'll note I got on the slide C quotes. A little later, I'm going to give you some quotes about this from fellows who are a lot smarter than I am about scientific things like this that indicate maybe it's not as sure as we're being told in our schools and colleges and articles about this rate of decay. And remember, that affects your calculations about that hourglass. Okay? Here's the second one. Here's that second assumption, that there's been no loss or gain. In other words, that nobody's added any salt to the top or nobody's removed any salt from the bottom, that none escaped some way through a hole or something. That's what you're assuming. It is impossible to know the effect of weather, water, and gases on these rocks over millions and even billions of years. Could they have affected by these rocks, for example, are found in magma and or this radioactivity? Could it have inherited something from the surrounding area? In other words, add more salt? Could something else have happened so far as temperature changes or water or gases that would affect how quickly the decay process went away and so there was less in it? We don't know. All we know is our little window of time. Then the third thing, how much of the radioactive elements were there when it was formed? How much salt was in that timer when it started? I told you, but you have to depend on that. There was nobody around to watch the timer in the beginning, except one witness, and they won't take his witness. So, how much was present when the rock was formed? Radioactive elements can be inherited from source area, like magma and rocks. Samples taken a few feet apart. This, you can go find this for yourself. Samples taken a few feet apart can give ages that differ by many hundreds or millions of years. Alex was talking about that after our last class, something he had read or seen. How samples taken, I mean, just close to one another. One known to be much younger, but vary by billions of years. And maybe the one that's known to be younger actually tests older. So you don't know about... Yes, Sally?
One thing, without having to even go through all of this, to me it's easy to understand, especially when you're teaching children, that God had the power to create a mature earth, just like He created a mature man and mature plants and animals. God could have created an earth that was 50 million years old, just like He created Adam, was a grown man. And the other thing that I wanted to say was, there was a thing on that I saw on the internet today. The Pope has declared, I don't know if you read this or not, that anybody that believes that God was like a magician and could just make things happen is just nuts.
Okay. So Sally's comment is that God could have created a mature earth, which in fact He did. No question about that. And unfortunately, religious leaders do not believe the very things we're studying, and so you can imagine the impact of a religious leader like the Pope saying something like that. The problem with telling someone that God created a mature earth, which I agree with Sally, I think she's right, I think the Bible confirms that. Now your child goes to school and they say, look, I don't know what you were told, but look, here's what science shows about the rate of radioactive decay. This is a proven fact that radioactive isotopes decay at this rate. And so we can calculate how old this rock is by this rate. So if that's a fact, now you've got a conflict, it seems like. But if I can show my children that what you're told as a fact is not a fact, then we're back to the mature earth again. Yes, sir.
Many what ifs that you've thrown in since you've been standing up there tonight, how can it be a fact?
Good point. There's so many what ifs. And I've told you that, but let me show you some quotes, okay? Here's an evolutionist, William Stansfield. He's a PhD, California Polytech State. This is just a quote down at the bottom of the slide. I probably can't read it. But if you're interested, I can give you that data where it's found. He said, it is obvious that radiometric techniques, listen now, this is not a preacher, this is an evolutionist, he's a PhD, doesn't mean he renounced evolution, it's just a statement he made, may not be the absolute dating methods that they are claimed to be. Age estimates on a given geological stratum by different radiometric methods are often quite different, sometimes by hundreds of millions of years. There is no absolutely reliable long-term radiological clock, unquote. How's your child going to argue with the professor? Or the teacher. Give him this quote. Sir, you have a PhD? Here's a PhD. Here's what he said. At least, as Jeff has pointed out, there's some what ifs here. This guy says this, and he's an evolutionist. Here's another. This is by Frederick B. Juneman. Work, Secular Catastrophism. And here's what he said. The age of our globe is presently thought to be some 4.5 billion years based on radio decay rates of uranium and thorium. Such confirmation may be short-lived, as nature is not to be discovered quite so easily. There has been in recent years the horrible realization that radio decay rates are not as constant as previously thought, nor are they immune to environmental influence. Let me stop. What's he saying? They could be contaminated. The rates could be affected. See? All right, back to the quote. And this could mean that the atomic clocks are reset during some global disaster. Let's get out of the quote a minute. What possible global disaster could affect the rocks and their rates? The flood. Right. Now, not that he believes that. I'm just reading his quote. Then he said, an event which brought the Mesozoic to a close may not be 65 million years ago, but rather within the age and memory of man. You reckon your children hear that in their science class? But see, there's another side. Remember, those of you that remember Paul Harvey, you younger people probably don't. He had a little segment called The Rest of the Story. Well, here's the rest of the story. And what I've done, you can do. You can get on the internet, those of you who have a computer, know how to use it. You can just type in a search about the reliability of radioactive rates or something like that, and you'll bring up these kind of things that you can read for yourself. So anyway, we've looked at evidences within the Bible that the 6 days of creation are designed to be taken by the reader as 6 days, as we think about them, normal days. The undermining thing is, how can that be so in view of this undeniable scientific fact of radioactive decay rate showing the Earth is several billion years old? Well, it's not an undeniable fact of science. And that's what we need to understand. Okay. Now, the person who submitted the topic about the 6 days had a follow-up with some questions, and so the first question is the one that was submitted, and in that vein, I had some others that I had ran across in time past that we'll put with it. So we'll look now, and you should have a sheet that I had in the back. I see there's none left. Some of you had picked it up and hopefully worked on it. But questions about the 6 solar days of creation. So here's the question that was submitted. How did God create Eve on the 6th day, but yet Adam had to name the animal before determining to make Eve? Okay. So that's the question. First of all, there's much that we don't know about that 6th day, about all the days. There's a lot of things we'd like to know, but there's a lot we don't know. For example, it says Adam named the animals. How did God get them to Adam? How did he bring them before him? I don't know. What did he name them? It says he named them. He named these kinds. Well, what terms did he use? I don't know. He didn't speak English and say dog, cat, horse. I don't know what he did. And then the third thing is, in fact, when you talk about after their kind, you may remember on the chart I did not put species. Just avoid the word species because it's such a variable word. I remember years ago reading a book by a zoologist, and he was pointing out that species depends on who defines it. It's arbitrary as to what a species is. Just use the biblical term, kind. And so what were the kinds? I don't know. What were the major groups? I don't know. A lot about that I don't know. You know Deuteronomy 29:29, don't you? If not, if it's not familiar with you, turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 29:29. Moses in this sermon had been talking about the people's future and what would happen. And he said some rather astounding things about their future. No doubt their hearts were filled with all kinds of questions about that. But he said, verse 29, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of this law. Because they didn't understand or know all they wanted to know, did not keep from the prophecies Moses made coming to pass, or God doing what he said he would do. And it would have been foolish on their part to say, I don't understand some things, therefore I don't believe it's so. You can see how foolish that would have made them in the light of later history. Moses said, don't worry about that. Here's where your concern needs to be. You know what the law says. Do it. Well, over in the New Testament, the book of Acts in chapter 1, when John the Baptist appeared on the scene and then later Jesus, there was a lot of interest in the fulfillment of the promises concerning the coming kingdom through the seed of David. And when would that power and dominion be restored? And so the apostles asked the Lord a question. He's already died and he's risen again and he's talking to his apostles. And note verse 7. They ask him in verse 6, Lord, is it at this time you're restoring the kingdom to Israel? Isn't it interesting how he responded? He didn't answer their question. He said, it is not for you to know. There's just some things God said, it's not for you to know. It is not for you to know the times or epochs which the Father has fixed by his own authority. Can we live with that? You that are parents, you might tell your children, you cannot sit down and eat a whole gallon of ice cream. Why not? You can't ride your tricycle in the middle of the street. Well, why not? They don't understand, maybe. You do. It's not for them to understand why. It's for them to do what you tell them to do because you have their interest at heart. And so how did God do all of this on that sixth day? I do not know. However, observe that when you read Genesis 2, verse 19, sometimes we make assumptions that are not in the text. In Genesis chapter 2, in verse 19, it says, out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and brought them to the man. Verse 20, the man gave names to all the cattle. And we read the word every and we read the word all and we think that means every single one that was upon the face of the earth. But the fact is, there are just so many evidences of the fact in the Bible that the word all or the word every sometimes refers to all kinds. I've got some illustrations here. In Genesis chapter 24 and verse 10, Genesis chapter 24 and verse 10. So the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out. Now this is the New American Standard Version. And in the New American Standard Version, it says, with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. But in the King James Version, the New King James Version, and the American Standard Version, it says he departed with all his master's goods. That was some camel. Have every single thing Abraham owned loaded on that camel. The New American Standard translators understood that, so they didn't do as accurate a translation, but they're trying to give the English reader the idea. A variety. In other words, all kinds of is the idea. You can clearly see that in the text. Look again at Acts chapter 10 and verse 12. Here's this vision that Peter had. And when Luke writes it, he says, in this sheet that he saw, there were in it all. If you've got the New American Standard Version, you have some italicized words after the word all. Kinds of. Again, the translators are trying to help the English reader see the idiom. That all doesn't mean he had all the four-footed animals that existed in that sheet. All kinds of four-footed animals. Okay? And then another illustration is Acts 2:17 about all flesh, but we don't have time, so we'll have to move on here. So let's think about this, him naming all these animals. Adam was of superior intelligence. He didn't have atmosphere to deplete his mind. He didn't have things that worked on his body to deplete his mind. He came fresh from the hand of God. No telling what his mental powers were. But nevertheless, let's just throw something out. How long would it take him? If he could name 10 kinds in 1 minute, that would be what, every 6 seconds? How long does it take to say dog, cat, horse, whatever? So this is pretty liberal, you know, 1 minute, 10, in 5 hours, he could have named 3,000 kinds. What if he did it in 1 minute, he named 20? So anyway, I don't know. There's a lot I just simply do not know. What I do know is this. In Genesis 2, the reason that that's recorded, the way it's recorded, is the statement at the end of verse 20. But for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. So as the reader reads this, you've got all these animals. Adam is alone, verse 18. But there's not found a suitable companion in all the various kinds of animals in the world. And so what does God do? I'm going to make him a helper suitable. A help meet, M-E-E-T. That's what you have next is the creation of the woman. That was the purpose of that. And we know from our previous studies that we've done the last class or two, here's what we can know. We can see what the purpose was, and we can know that the word day in Genesis 1 and 2 was talking about solar days. So that we can know. All right, another question quickly. How could there be light and darkness on days 1 through 3 when the sun wasn't put in the sky until day 4? Good question. First of all, Jeremiah 32:17 says concerning God, there's nothing too difficult for God. If God can make sun, God can make light without sun. There's nothing too difficult for God. And so, and if you go back, in fact, look at Jeremiah 32, you'll see how he, if I'm not mistaken, let me go back and look just to be sure, but I'll tell you something wrong. Lord God, behold, you've made the heavens and the earth by your great power and by your outstretched arm. Nothing is too difficult for you. He appeals to the creation as evidence of the very thing that he said. Now, does it say that the day, the light of the first 3 days was there by sunlight? It doesn't. It doesn't say that. Where was the light from? People have tried to give suggestions, and I don't know. There's other sources of light than sun. The fact is, the Bible said there was. There were some other things here I can't explain. How could plants come into being without seeds? How could that happen? If God can make plants without seeds, he can certainly make light without sun. Can't he? What was the purpose of the sun, moon, and stars? For signs and seasons. Not simply to give light, but for man's benefit. For man's benefit. So it has signs and seasons. So how would those people understand it? You know, because I can't understand how something happened doesn't mean it's not a reality. Can you imagine somebody that's never seen electricity? You say, look, if I plug this cord right in here, this little old globe's going to light up. You say, you're crazy. That ain't going to happen. Here, take this fork and put it in that socket. If the guy doesn't believe you, what's he going to do? Because he can't explain it doesn't mean it's not so. See? If you said that a year or 6 months before the Wright brothers flew their airplane, there's no way a machine heavier than air can fly. That's stupid. Who'd have been stupid? Because you can't explain it because you've never seen it doesn't mean it doesn't happen. The question is there credible evidence for something to happen? And if there is a God and we have a credible record, then certainly it can be. Okay, well, my time is about up. I wanted to explore some other things here. I wished I had time to do that, but we're not going to have time. I'd have to run through it so quickly, it probably would not be just to the class. I think I gave you some material on your sheets that you can look at if you wish about this idea that the seventh day hasn't ended, and none of those verses say that. But from an assumption about those things, further conclusions are made. I do want to conclude with a passage over here. And get down to it if I can. Right, this one right here. So, we've looked at the evidence. We've looked at a number of things. We've just barely touched the fringe of the garment, but it gets down to what Psalm 19 says, you make a decision. The law of the Lord is perfect. The testimony of the Lord is sure. The precepts of the Lord are right. The commandment of the Lord is pure. The fear of the Lord is clean. The judgments of the Lord are true. Which do you believe? That or evolution? I'll tell you this in my own personal experience. When I was a young man, getting ready to go to college, I began to study about evolution. I began to buy books and do research. The more I learned, the more I read, the less faith I had in anything I was told about evolution. I found that they were wrong about so much, and they didn't tell the people they were wrong, and they would twist the facts to support their theories, to where I got to where instead of, oh, well, the scientists say it, so it must be true, it was the other way around. If they say it, I want some evidence. You know, if a person lies to you once, that's one thing. They lie to you 3 times, 10 times, or even if they're not lying, they say something emphatically, being honest, you find out they're wrong. They say something else emphatic, oh, they're wrong. You find that out 5 times. When the 6th time they tell you something, do you jump on the bandwagon? You say, wait a minute. That's where I'm at. Thank you for your good attention.